Okay, so I really admire Bill Murray. Apparently, Bill Murray checks his correspondence once or twice a year, only accepts correspondence by handwritten letters. I've thought, that would be nice, just handwritten letters. I could probably dedicate some time to that.
Welcome to How I Work, a show about the tactics used by leading innovators to get so much out of their day. I'm your host, Dr. Amantha Imba. I'm an organizational psychologist, the CEO of Inventium, and I'm obsessed with finding ways to optimize my workday. On today's show, my guest is Dr. Jason Fox. I've known Jason for the best part of a decade, and like me, he's a scientist at heart and has a bias for strategies that are grounded in research. So in case you haven't come across Jason is someone who travels literally all over the world, helping leaders from companies such as Microsoft, Salesforce, McDonald's, and Toyota in the area of motivation design. Jason is also the best-selling author of The Game Changer and How to Lead a Quest, and in 2016 was awarded Keynote Speaker of the Year. Now, something I really like about how Jason organizes his working life is that he thinks a lot about regular rhythms and rituals. And in this chat, we talk about many of the ones that he's incorporated into his life, from his daily rituals through to weekly, monthly, quarterly, and even annual rituals. I think that there's so much great stuff to take from this chat. And on that note, let's go over to Jace to hear about how he works. Jace, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Very good to be chatting with you. It's always quite delightful doing these interviews when it's someone that you've known for many years.
Yeah, it's fun.
You're one of my closest friends, so this is exciting. Now, one of the things that I know that you do every year is that you will think about a word that is kind of, I'm not going to do it justice. It's like your theme song word for the year. And I remember one year, this was a few years ago, it was December, and we were out with a group of friends and we were eating pancakes. And your word for the year, I believe, was pirate.
That's right.
And your pancake, they got the order wrong. And as a pirate, you asserted yourself. And you said, this is wrong, and we got it fixed. Is that right? Is my memory correct?
No, I think what happened was I was like, oh, it looks like they're packing up and I don't want to keep you guys waiting, so I'll just accept this. And I think Shannon, your partner Shannon, asked me, is this what a pirate would do? And I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. And so I did then assert myself, which was part of what the word triggers in such moments. So that was handy there. But yeah, so there's this notion of choosing one word is in the direct opposition to the New Year's resolutions or the general obsession people have around SMART goals, from a motivational folklore perspective, the more specific you are, the more concrete, measurable it is, the more likely you are to succeed. And that is true within stable environments. But if we're thinking about ourselves, our growing and evolving self, in all the complexity of a whole year, I find it much more effective and serving to choose one word to serve as a contextual beacon for the year ahead. And what this word does is allow you to stumble. It allows you to it serves, I mean, the year of wizard at the moment, and the notion behind the word wizard was, I kind of want to actually go lock myself away in my tower and write more and think more and do more wizardly things. And I was also, a wizard is never late, and I was more interested in playing with how is it that I keep on building these calendar months, days, weeks, where I just feel as though I'm constantly late, rushing from one meeting to another. And so in many ways, this word serves to guide some principles around the decisions we make and the behaviors we enact. And so that's kind of why I like choose and recommend folk choose one word.
And what's your process for picking your word? And like we're recording this podcast right at the end of 2018 and it'll be released in 2019. So have you picked your word for 2019?
The word next year, I suspect, will be fool, F-O-O-L. And the fool is a mythic word. It's an archetype. Fools, foolishness is often where, compared to conventional society, it seems like what I'm doing is foolish, but I often feel that I'm holding back from where I need to go. There's a book that, as you know, I'm dying to write, but I've been holding back because I've been worried about, is this really commercially viable? Are people going to resonate with this? And it's completely the wrong questions I need to be asked. How much more foolish can I be with this? There's plenty of other reasons around that. I feel that the word thing takes a good 9 months to download. It takes 9 months to integrate it into your character. And the gestation period for a new word might take a while, or some people just intuitively know. The process for choosing a word, often you'll look at the patterns of your life. And so, even though this is narrative fallacy, it's not true, sometimes it serves to think of your life as though it were a story, an autobiography. It's not linear, it's not like that, but it sometimes serves. If you were to look back at the last few years of your life as though it were a story, would you identify these patterns that you find frustrating? If you're reading the story, be like, oh, I can't believe we're at this point in time, it's 2019 and I'm still doing that, or I'm still stuck in this. And these patterns hint at something. Now, there's a wonderful book called Immunity to Change by Lisa LaHaye and Robert Keegan. And this identifies the notion of hidden commitments. And often we try to make progress in a particular domain, but we come across these hidden commitments or conflicting values that are hard to or difficult to reconcile. And this is where, rather than setting a specific goal, identifying what is this hidden commitment, or what is this need that I can surface? And it might often start with a fairly boring word like balance, health, love, happiness. But then if we go, I sometimes use a visual thesaurus. So you Google visual thesaurus and you put in these boring root words, and then it spirals off into these other potential words. And if you find something that you think this is memorable and sticky enough to serve as a trigger, so if I gift it to the closest people around me and they're aware that this is the word, you know, the year of wizard or jester or pirate or gentleman or whatever it is, if they're aware of that and I'm aware of their words, in certain moments we might be able to just call them back in line with their intention. And so amidst all the complexity, it serves as a beautiful trigger to bring us back in line with what we intend for ourselves in the year, rather than just getting swept up in the same default pattern that we often find ourselves in.
How's that worked for you in 2018 with the word wizard? Like, what's the time where someone has said, well, come on, you're... be more wizardly.
Yeah. It's worked pretty terribly so far. but it's been, I mean, okay. So although this wasn't what you said, it's what appeared in my mind when you said it. I was sharing with you just how fatiguing I've found full day facilitations. And it just seems that I've booked in the strategic offsites, leadership offsite, where it's a full day, like wrestling with all the nuances of a leadership team going through change. And I've been exhausted. I've almost needed to take a couple of days off after these events just to recover. And with your philosophies around deep work, your approach and your way of preserving the deep work time, which is so important, I agree it's important too, but I've just fallen into this pattern of not noticing or not allowing myself to tap into deep work as much as I could. And when you suggested that, do you really need to keep doing full days like this? Maybe there's another way that you can go about this. I was like, yeah, what would a wizard do, you know, in that regard? And so how that's translating is proactively, my year next year, and this is going to reek of privilege if folks hear this. So it's just I feel embarrassed about this, but it's the result of a lot of hard work in order to save up enough revenue so as to buffer what I intend for the next year. But I intend to take December, January off for months of deep work. Then April off for another month of deep work, and then July off for another month of deep work. And this correlates to the busy patches in my year. The reason for this amount of time is that there is a book in me that wants to be written, and it seems to benefit from consecutive days of deep work where I can throw myself into this and pick up where I left off. So that's kind of how Wizard is translating, and it's not so much this year, although it's been helpful. Last year I was away 50% of the year. This year I've only been away 30% of the year. I have a goal next year to be home for at least 300 nights. We'll see how that translates. So
that's cool. And how do you make something like that happen when you've got a goal of being home for 300 nights? Like, What are you going to do differently?
So Kim, my wonderful partner, who also helps me, I'm very lucky that as a business manager, we and she's a veterinarian, she's an illustrator, she's a writer, she's so much more than this one small task, but vital task that she does for me. We track what our daily rate looks like. We track the number of nights away. We have partner meetings, which we're terrible at keeping into a good rhythm of. But whenever we do it, it's a way of us checking in. How are we progressing with fulfillment factors, like number of nights at home? Fulfillment factors also include number of times gone to the gym each week. It includes things like us having a weekend away once a month or something, or not away, but a weekend where we do things. So we track in with those alongside with the business results. So when we're considering the work that we do, it's alongside life fulfillment factors. So we can kind of keep things in check.
That's cool. What does that look like? Is that a poster on the wall? Is that an app?
It should be a poster on the wall. Primacy, the first order retrieval is so important. Instead, it's buried away maybe three folders deep in our Dropbox and pulled out once a month. This is terrible. Like the fact you asked me this, yeah. So yeah, it should be. I mean, I think one of my challenges at the moment is currently we're in a small apartment in Fitzroy. We're moving upstairs, which allows me to have my own home studio, but there hasn't been any place for these artifacts to live. And so it's kind of, and I think that's been a big factor in it not being as effective, because it hasn't had that visual primacy. I think about some agile work environments, which I know you've worked with some of these places, where they have that. Well, Inventium has like the key things up on the wall, like, and so every time you're walking past, you can't help but see the most important things. We don't currently have that. We should have that.
Okay. I want to come back to something you said when you were talking about a wizard never runs late. And
that's Gandalf, the quote. A wizard is never late.
Okay. All right. That's good to know for my wizard knowledge. And I don't know, this might sound like a weird question, but it's something I do think about. Like, how do you not run late? Like, what have you changed in your behavior?
My relationship to time itself. it comes down to, okay, so I've become incredibly suspicious of the I'm using air quotes here, optimized days. Optimized being, let's just fit in as many meetings as we can. So my previous philosophy was, I don't really like meetings and phone calls and stuff like that, so let's just batch them. And what would happen is there'd be not as much buffer time and things would spill over because I'm not good at keeping to time and stuff, and it would just end up feeling horrible days. Also the time relationship thing is around how can we create, like, is our questioning, do we actually need to have this meeting, or what's some ways that we can create some buffer and grace so that when meetings do happen, I think this parallels your deep work ritual. I'm a morning person too, so it seems to be that I'm some sort of lark character as well. I feel like I'm a lark that sleeps in.
How does that work?
It's just the reason for that is because for the same reason, I don't think that I finish well. So I'm still sometimes thinking about work after dinner and the writing and ideas and stuff. And that translates to a later night going to sleep, and 8 hours of sleep is very important. And so the day shifts like that. But bracketing phone meetings and emails and all that stuff into the afternoon is the thing that works for me. So that allows me the grace to be arriving and be present and not have a day chopped up with meetings.
So
I'm frequently late, though. Not intentionally, but it's not necessarily about the literal interpretation of lateness, but more how can we set up time so it doesn't allow me, so I'm not in the situation where I find myself late.
Something I've been reflecting on in my own life is that a lot of the time if I'm feeling stress, it's because I feel like I'm going to be late. And often I'm not late. I'm a very punctual person, but I've just become very aware in the last few weeks that my moments of stress are related to moving from A to B, to get from like one meeting to the next or something like that. And I'm wondering for you, like I'm not sure then if lateness becomes stressful for you, but I'm curious, like, does it? And also how do you manage stress, the general stress?
So A lot of this stems to one of my favorite books and concepts is anti-fragility, anti-fragile, things that gain from disorder. And what I'm mindful of is the heaviness that sometimes can be attached to a particular day. So think about a particular meeting. Some meetings are corporate teleconference calls where they've got seven people jumping on the line, there's some passcode and it's on the internet and I have to get out my laptop and I might be in the cab on the way to the airport or who knows what. So I've learned to nib those things in the bud, because often a one-on-one chat with the key person who knows the stuff via the phone is much more effective than some teleconference where there's all those awkward pauses, no one knows when and where to speak. So that's one of the ways. I mean, this time thing in and of itself is, I've had to allow myself more time to meander. With writing comes a lot more reading, I've found. There's this thing where the more you think you know something, the more you realize you don't know something. And so the avenues that my writing takes me opens me up to, okay, there's some foundational work that I need to get across. And then it just ends up being that the type of day that I have is actually, you know what, you're asking me a question and I'm thinking I'm due to refresh what my own understanding of this is. And partly this is where I like the ritual of choosing one word. We're coming at the moment to an end of the year. It's where I reflect on, all right, what's working, what's not working. The primacy of the timing is exact an example of something that's not working. Because I don't have that happening.
Well, how do you make decisions? Because I know that we're quite different in how we make decisions. I naturally want to just jump to a solution and I have to force myself to just sit in the messy, ambiguous space, and you're pretty much the polar opposite.
Of course, the ambiguity.
So what does decision-making look like in your world? How do you make a decision? Like, and maybe if you can think of an example decision, how that's worked.
Okay. Well, okay, cool. So there's probably different flavors of decision. There are simple admin decisions, there are detailed decisions and things like that, of which I don't seem to have much appetite for whatsoever. So I often allow Kim to make those decisions. She has a very good understanding of my world. And there's a lot that we can process through. I think it's mainly out of her frustration for my inability to dedicate time to what I consider to be what you might call the shallow work decisions or the minor things, because sometimes...
What's an example of a minor decision?
Choosing a location of where to meet with someone.
Okay.
Because that email might come to me, I'm like, oh, okay, well, it's Friday afternoon and it's in the danger zone where cafes close but restaurants aren't open. What type of conversation is it? Are we talking about sensitive stuff? Because if that's the case, then we might want something with a booth. And is it risky if it's like a boozy place, or should we go coffee place? And what's the vibe that we're looking for here? Do we want it at Fitzroy? Or, you know, and then I'm like, and then writing this polite email and stuff like that. The whole process takes maybe 20 minutes. And that's something that's probably easier to answer in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
The bigger decisions are what is the audience and topic and title of the next book that I'm working on? What are the things that, as far as the market knows, where am I going to start positioning in that regard? And I've experienced the hangover effect of positioning strongly. My first book, The Game Changer, came out at the same time that gamification became a thing, and I was known as that for some time. So this is big, and it has an impact that lasts for maybe half a decade or more. So that's something that I meander my way through. That's probably an extreme version. And then the other decisions are probably along the lines of what projects to lean into. Each quarter, I like to think about doing between 1 to 3 significant projects each quarter, of which maybe only one of them actually happens, and across the year only 2 or 3 may actually be successful. But this might refer to particular collaborations, events we might host, or things like that. My decision-making process for that is usually to brood for a while on it. So I guess Cal Newport calls this, oh no, Ryan Holiday calls this the drawdown period in his book, The Perennial Seller. It's where you're angsting around a particular idea. And then there's this kind of hunch or an intuitive reckoning where you sense that the time is right. Because my natural disposition is to relish in the benefits of procrastination for percolating around an idea, whereas you're not blessed with that. I would then need to do something that's like committing to some sort of public date to actually make it happen. So this is usually where I'll anchor things. I'll announce some sort of event a few months into the future and plan to have something ready. This is how we launched that independent magazine. We organized this big event, whiskey tasting, coffee tasting, Cleverness Biannual, Thoughtful Provocations for the Quietly Dissatisfied, was launched because we had the event on, because there was that external factor that got me going.
That's interesting. So you find that that's quite helpful for you, setting that almost like external announcement, and then it's like, okay, well, decision's made, and I gotta get there.
Playing with your own cognitive dissonance, announcing something, and then you're kind of stuck with this situation. Like I have a newsletter list of over 11,000 folks that, you know, if I announce something there and then it doesn't happen, I'm filled with this existential angst of, shit, I said this to all these folks. I better actually do this, or I have to kind of come up with some lame story or reason as to why I didn't. And I find that personally quite a powerful motivating force to bridge that cognitive dissonance that I create for myself. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. You've mentioned rhythms a couple of times. So you've obviously got the annual rhythm around the word, yep. And you've got a quarterly rhythm around your pick 1 to 3 projects per quarter that you want to spend time on and lean into. What other rhythms have you got in your life?
I do have a daily rhythm, and this is for non-travel days. And that is that I will generally wake up somewhere between 6:30 and 7:30. The first thing I'll do is, in these ideal days, is after I have a coffee that I make for myself, which is a fairly ritualistic process of a pour-over coffee with locally roasted beans. And that process in and of itself is a bit of a mindfulness activity, and I haven't looked at my phone at this stage. It's just being in flow. It gets me centered for the day. It's probably where I'm pacing through in my mind, all right, what's the shape of the day look like? I think you do this the day beforehand. You have your wonder list to identify it. I'm kind of feeling my way through them. I'll then skate on my skateboard to a local cafe. I arrive there. I then open up the app Ulysses, which is one of my favorite writing apps. The reason I like Ulysses is if you're on the laptop or the iPad or tablet, it can do this full screen mode where I have a black background and all you're seeing is the cursor and you're writing. I set the target to 500 or 750 words, depending on where we're at, and I do morning pages. I write in free flow writing for at least 500 words. That is a means of me to identifying patterns or things that are percolating in the subconscious that I might not otherwise be aware of. That writing then gets uploaded into Day One Journal. I like Day One Journal because when I upload it onto Day One, sometimes it'll show me what I wrote this exact day a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And it's disturbing sometimes how familiar these patterns are. It's like, oh, this time 2 years ago, I had pretty much the same angst. What's going on there? And there's these cues and reminders that there's always... While there's deep work for us to do and the work that we're putting out to the world, there's also deep inner work that we need to be doing around recognizing and knowing ourselves more. So the first 500 words for myself, I then dedicate a block of time to the next bunch of words. And this is more, rather than the number of words, this is the amount of time that I dedicate, and that's writing time for the book, my newsletter, or for other hefty work like that. I find deep work when done well is quite fatiguing in a good way. So usually when I surface out of the fugue that comes from the deep work, I'll usually skate home. That movement helps. I'll have lunch. Lunch is one of those things where then I'm checking my email, I'm dipping into the internet. And then after through lunch, I then have a period of light work, and then I have either gym or a long walk. And the golden rule that is adhered to most of the time is that there's no work from dinner onwards. So cooking dinner, have dinner, and then I'm chilling in the evening. That's what the daily rhythm looks like in an ideal day.
Wow. How many days are ideal days?
So I find that October and November are particularly busy times in my world, perhaps your world too, whereas December, January, February, not so busy. We have a, at the end of the day, Kim and I have a daily, we have a gratitudes calendar. And this is an annual calendar, a perpetual calendar. There's two things this calendar does. One is we track the days where we've done deliberate physical activity. And that's where we simply get a dot. And this is partly a way of quickly visualizing what are the number of days that I've gone to the gym or done deliberate intense physical activity. Same with Kim. And there's usually a correspondence between the dots and the number of times that I've had to fly away to do client work. The other thing that we do is in the box is Kim and I write down something that we're grateful for, something that we appreciate, or something that's a highlight of the day. Recently, we wrote down that doing a pizza making course with you and our friends was like the highlight of our day. We loved it.
That was
this
cool.
Is so cool. But it's, of course, you know, the power of gratitudes and the science behind it. This is a lovely way to cap the day. So we're not thinking about all the unfinished things. We're thinking about the things that do well. But it also highlights some correlations and some interesting patterns around what we like and what makes us feel good.
That's nice. That's quite inspiring. I might start doing that myself. So I want to stay on the topic of different rhythms, like in terms of weekly and monthly rhythms. Do they exist in your world as well?
Yeah. So weekly, there's in an ideal world, there's a partner meeting. This happens only about half the time. The partner meeting is us, Kim and I, checking in the business, but it's also checking in with each other's fulfillment factors. What's working for us? What might be getting in the way? We refresh our fulfillment factors at least or whenever needed, but it usually translates to every year. Things for me include curiosity, includes a word like vitality, and vitality includes physical activity, time in nature, time with friends and things like that. Weekly is also a good chance to identify friction. So friction are the things that happen each week. These are the things that if you nip them in the bud early, they don't have to turn into something bigger later. But these things, they're little pesky, annoying things. But if there's a space to be like, hey, I found it like it takes way too much time to do this, so we could probably do this better. That appears weekly. Monthly, we try to have some sort of full day dedicated to looking at the business, looking at what we're doing. And that's something where we try to go beyond the operational stuff and bring a little bit more creativity into it. Like, what's a better way that we can do this? Or in the moment, I'm looking at my booking agreement and thinking, okay, the lawyers had a look at that. Can we humanize this at all? Are there any opportunities? Probably a dangerous thing to be focused on. But there's things that happen on the website or other things like that. It's just that monthly thing gives us a chance to look at it a little bit deeper. It also makes us think, do we want to host an event, or what's some quirky collaboration that Kim with her illustration and writing and myself, we might be able to put together. Quarterly, bigger projects. And there's also a seasonality to things. And midwinter, there's like a brooding time of deep work and writing and stuff. And yeah, midsummer is much more just stop working and allow some empty time into our world.
That's nice. I like the seasonality. It reminds me of the book by the Basecamp guys. It doesn't have to be crazy at work, where they talk about the seasonality of Basecamp and how in the summer months they'll do, I think, a 4-day, 32-hour week, and you know, winter will feel very different to summer, and it's seasonal. I like that a lot. I want to know, with your fulfillment factors, how did you know what they were? How did you uncover those?
So yeah, good question. And this is a good thing for, I think, any team leader to do for themselves and ask of their team as well. This came across where essentially I read an article about anti-goals. So if you think about the types of things within your day that contribute to a really crappy day, like a day full of meetings or, you know, not sleeping well, running late, think about all those things. That's the starting point. Then think about the times in your life where you've experienced extreme versions of this, like extreme lack of fulfillment. And then the flip side, wherever in the times, what's been going on where you felt really quite fulfilled? What have been the factors that contribute there? So I know there's this spiral that happens for me, that if I have a lot of time traveling, where I'm doing interstate or international work with clients, the flights, the time difference, the diet that changes when I'm in hotels, sleeping in different rooms, can set me on this little bit of a spiral in terms of health and making bad choices. I know also that if I have more than 3 days pass where I haven't done my morning pages or my morning ritual, that's usually an early indicator that something's going on here. If there's more than 3 days pass where I haven't had time to read books or feed my curiosity, which is a fulfillment factor, that's an early warning sign. And so all these things, if we look at these factors and distill it down to a list of three or five things, that's usually enough of a sense of like, all right, well, what does it look like if vitality, the fulfillment factor, is being met? And it looks like going to the gym 3 times a week, and it looks like getting good sleep and so on. You can usually distill it into something quite measurable. That's the process of how that comes about. And it's not a set and forget. I think some things become different priorities at different times, but it's something that serves us as a background reminder.
Okay, so you're kind of tapping into what are the things that frustrate you, and then kind of looking at what's the opposite, with the theory being that will
explore both extremes, and they provide the hints as to what's lacking or what's there in abundance, and what is that thing if you expand up into a high level of abstraction, what is that thing there? Yeah.
I like that. And that's nice that you do that with your partner, Kim, as well. That's a really nice ritual.
Yeah, well, and it's happened with some teams that I've helped facilitate this with, where they've gotten to know each other. It's really significant fulfillment factors. So for some folks, it's been, you know, if the time with family in the morning or in the evening and stuff is really, really important. And I know that there are times where we've got to stay back late at work, but there are just some things that are really vital. And for the rest of the team to know that means that they can champion their fulfillment factors more. Other things are like, you know, if it comes to a fulfillment factor around curiosity, for example, a culture around where there's an active live conversation around what are you reading or what things are you hearing from, that can help in that fulfillment factor too.
I remember going through the fulfillment process with you a few years ago now, and it's inspired me to pick that up again and do that again. You've mentioned that you travel a lot for work, which is the nature of the beast in terms of what you do. And I want to know, how do you use your time on planes? I find that I'm really curious. I've asked this of a few guests that do travel very frequently. What does the plane flight look like for you?
Okay, so there's two types of plane flights for me. There's the business class flights that happen for the way that our booking agreement currently is for any flights of 3 hours or more. It really ought to be business class, and it is most of the time. That's quite... it seems luxurious to many folks, but you know, the novelty wears off. What that turns into is not missing out on the opportunity to actually do work in a day, because the opportunity cost of some international engagements is huge. The business class just mitigates that. So if it's a flight like that, I wear the pajamas that are, you know, on the plane if it's a flight to LA or, you know, to Scandinavia or something.
Why not? They're so soft,
totally,
and comfortable.
It's like this, like a little club that you're in. And I just power in work. Like I don't actually watch movies directly most of the time, but then I watch it indirectly because of the screens around me, and it's this little game of like, what are they actually talking about from a nonverbal perspective? Like, I feel like the quality of acting is actually part of what influences how I communicate on stage, and so I actually find that partially fascinating. But otherwise, it's good music, noise-cancelling headphones. I use Neurophones, which are a headphone developed in Melbourne, which are fun. In terms of domestic flights and non-business class flights, I find that they're usually day trips. And so the day, that's more about energy preservation. I've been using Sam Harris's Waking Up course, which is a meditation course. Sam Harris is a really, really on point rational thinker. So if I'm not doing some sort of meditation part, I'll be listening to podcasts like yours, like his, and like a few others, and just chilling, or reading a paper book with a Blackwing pencil and underlining things that resonate with me. It just, yeah, depends on my mood at the time.
Do you have a plan? So with the international flights, do you have a plan of attack before you get on the plane as to how you're going to use your time?
I usually have just the sense of, cool, this is a chunk of time to write on this particular bit. And the plan usually looks like a combination. It looks like the things that I'm bringing onto the plane with me. So I love typing with the iPad. I love the keyboard that's there. And Ulysses, I love that app. Scrivener is also incredibly good for writing bigger, more complex pieces of work. I find the digital as well as an analog thing with me. So I might have notes sketched out on paper pad. That's as much of a plan as I go into. I like the ambiguity of being able to write and explore what emerges. And planes offer one of those rare experiences for emergent time. It seems like day to day, there is a need to actually make what's more tangible progress. Whereas a long flight, yeah, there's some space for stuff to emerge. And it might be that in allowing yourself not to be too focused on a specific goal, but to be disciplined in the pursuit of writing, stuff emerges that ends up being quite useful.
Okay, that makes sense. I want to talk about email because I feel like you must get a lot of email, and I feel like when I send you an email, I don't know whether I'm going to get a response, so I tend not to email you. I just text message you because I know that I'll get a quick response. So I want to know, How are you approaching email? And I also know you've got a secret email address that I think only friends know about. I've got it, and that, yes. And even if I email you at the secret email address, I still don't get a response. So how does email work in your world?
Okay, so I really admire Bill Murray. Apparently, Bill Murray checks his correspondence once or twice a year, only accepts correspondence by handwritten letters. I've thought, that would be nice, just handwritten letters. I could probably dedicate some time to that. I feel this conscious need to buck against the trend of urgency, this addiction to urgency that many folks within corporate environments have around emails, this expectation that people need to get back to you really quickly and really... You know, the more ASAP an email becomes, the more likely I am to kind of give it more time. It's kind of like being tailgated. Like, I'll just slow down if someone's like really impatient behind me. I don't know why. I can't help it with these inversions. It's also, for me, I have slowly trained the world to email me through particular channels. The reason being, early on in the day, you heard the glimpse of how I approach email beforehand for just choosing a meeting location. I don't know what it is. There's some deep work that I still need to do on myself around, unless I'm doing an email blitz. Like, there's a thing called the email game, which sometimes it sets you a time parameter. You get 30 seconds to decide what to do with each email. You get points. I can blitz through emails. So sometimes I save it for one big batch. I've got a big batch right now, and I'll blitz through.
What's a big batch?
It.
Like, how many are we talking?
So not including like all the junk ones, which you can just select and edit out. There's probably about a big batch to me feels like anything in the double digits, but a big batch is probably something like 30 emails.
Okay, 30 that each require an individual...
Considered response. That each, my silly mind believes, requires a tailored, you know, individual response.
Yes,
like it probably
where
doesn't.
Where to meet for lunch, yes.
Yeah, it probably doesn't. But so if I'm not blitzing them, then I'm really lucky that Kim's really on point. She's not cursed with my... need to consider every simple request through the most complex lens possible. So she helps me a lot in that regard. And for the few emails that do make their way into my inbox, I get around to it at some point. I often find that most of the emails aren't as important as people think that they are. And if they are, they find other means to get across. It is, again, one of those things that it's not something I necessarily recommend people plunge into, but I have been experimenting with this thing called inbox pause, which is this autoresponder where you can set specific times where you'll accept email, or where email comes in. I had it set up so that email would only come in after 3:30, but then the way that the autoresponder goes back and triggers things, I'm not so sure. I'm hoping there's a more elegant thing, but in terms of my own peace of mind, it helped me not to feel a sense of urgency about getting back to people. So it's a constant experimentation. I don't feel email is that nice a place. It doesn't allow for quality thinking or deep conversation at all. But in terms of functional logistics, I understand it does serve it sometimes.
Mm. So you're not really like drawn into your inbox. It sounds like it's more a repellent as opposed to something that you're really dying to get into.
The inbox reflects a whole bunch of demands on my time. And because it might be a symptom because of the amount of travel that I've had or something, and it might be a protective mechanism where I really want to write this book, and deep work is the thing that I love most, and it's also the thing I believe adds the most value. So if I'm not writing, speaking, or doing similar things of high value work, then I'm really wary as to the impact that can have. So I glance at email, I see the things. I really wish I could just touch it once and then leave it, but a lot of it goes into the incubator, which is probably not switched on, you know, the room temperature incubator, you know, the fruit dryer or dehydrator that takes us, you know, 7 days to,
That's funny. I wish I need more of your email slowness, I feel. I mean, you know, like you kind of train people with the way that you respond to emails and the pace, and I have to deliberately slow myself down.
You know, so going back to the word thing, the wizard thing, the language of which I use in some emails is sometimes, it's got some character and flair to it, which I think allows me some level of forgiveness amongst folks, and some people tend to relish in it. So when I do eventually reply, it is in character a little bit, my own character, but, you know, I somehow seem to get away with it. But I don't, again, thinking with empathy for the folks working in a large organization is probably a career-limiting strategy to adopt this. But if you're Might the type be. Of person... if you're the type of person who, you know, who makes a living because of their thinking, then... you know, this is the way that's been worked for me. Having said that, it still generates anxiety and angst. So if I had learned from you and actually handle these things sooner, chances are I might be actually happier. So I don't think my way is the way, but okay. It just seems to be a way that seems to work.
Okay. I want to ask about speaking gigs. So something that I think we both experience is that often people will ask us to speak at things and they will pay us a fee, which is set. And other times people will ignore the fact that this is one of the ways that we make a living and ask us to speak for free. And I'm curious, like I know like in my life I've thought a lot about how I decide what to say yes to and what to say no to. And the decision of whether to speak for free or not, because it is a frequent occurrence being asked to speak for free, is something that I've, you know, debated in my mind. How do I create rules around that for a while? And I haven't quite landed on anything perfect, but it's evolving. And I want to know for you, how does that process work for you when you're getting a request, they've got no budget, and how do you decide whether to say yes or whether to say no?
There's a third option here, and this is an opportunity that we often take, and this is where the privilege of having built profile and being in a position where you are getting these requests, that it provides an opportunity for you to connect them with maybe an emerging speaker or a speaker who maybe doesn't have as many runs on the board, but you think you admire their thinking or perspective there. So the first response for this stuff is often, love to. This is a writing year, as any opportunity effectively removes me from the market and also means that I can't write anything on that day. We do need to charge for this. It also takes up a fair bit of headspace in the lead up to it, and not to mention the travel time as well. So if there's no budget, we do have a few folks in mind that you might want to consider, and then we give a list of like two or three folks that they might want to consider that might match their theme. Again, this is another one that those emails I could blow a heap of time on, so it's usually Kim that handles this stuff. But sometimes there are gigs where it just is so aligned to your values. So then I think about things in terms of impact. If it's Impact and ease, probably. If it's a really large audience for a cause that I'm very passionate about, we'd then start to consider it. And there are options that we can bring into play, like maybe we do a book signing there, or maybe there's something, I don't know. Or if it's like this charming little group and it's in Melbourne and I can just catch the tram there and I feel, you know, heartened by it and I don't have to put much prep time into it. You know, maybe that's the thing. Don't get new ideas, folks. Maybe that's the thing.
You can have all these quirky little clubs contacting you after this going, we're just a tram right away.
The thing that I avoid is the murky middle ground. Like, I don't get into conversations like, oh, what about $500 or things like that. It's just, it's not actually like that. It's really, it's not about time per hour. It's not that. It's a silly game that we're in. It can be incredibly high impact in some organizations at key moments to have that provocation and perspective filtering through senior leadership and all the organizations, so they have a new framework, a new language to work with. And at other times, you know, I know that I'm getting booked because there's an entertainment component to it. There's, you know, people are feeling good and they're like, wow, I love that. So it's a funny game, but for our own sanity and preserving the deep work that's really important and the reason we're getting asked for this stuff in the first place, we need to preserve some integrity around the value.
Okay, that makes sense. So I want to finish up with some questions. I call them rapid fire questions, but the irony is they are never answered rapidly by any of my guests. And it's about what are you consuming? Because I think it's so hard for the average person to know what should they consume, because there's so much information out there and it can be a huge time zap. And so I want to start with books, because I know that you read a lot. And I'm curious, like maybe in the year of 2018, what were, like, you know, a couple of sort of standout highlight books for you?
Mm-hmm. Three books. The Listening Society by Hansi Freinacht, which is looking at political metamodernism, metamodern philosophy and political philosophy. Skin in the Game, which came out early in the year, which is another book by Nassim Taleb, which looks at the hidden asymmetries in life. And the third book is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Harari, which is a very apt sense around what we need to be thinking about in this day and age.
How do you read a book? I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah. If it's nonfiction, it's a physical book nowadays. Ideally the smaller version so I can travel with it. I have a Blackwing pencil, but any soft lead pencil will work. I have a sharpener with me and I underline. And if it's particularly apt to point, I'll put an asterisk in the column. And then after reading the book, I will ideally, and most of the time, write up my own summary of the key notes of things that I got from the book.
Nice. That's very disciplined. How about podcasts? What are podcasts and podcasts that you're loving and regularly consuming?
Yeah, cool. There's this podcast called How I Work. Which is great. No, it's quite seriously. I loved the first ones that I plunged in at random, but the Rachel Botsman interview you had, like, that opened up new ways for me to work. So thank you. I love it. And I love the work that you do and keep on going. It's so good, particularly for fluffy, nefarious folk like me. I also like Sam Harris's podcast. I like the way that he questions things and doesn't settle for what can often be polite and platitudinous conversations. He's really able to go a bit deeper. Jocelyn Glyer's Hurry Slowly. I like that one quite a lot. A mate of mine, Josh Jansen, with a friend of his, Tommy Jacket, does the Daily Talk Show, which is every single day, every weekday they've made an episode.
Wow.
It's crazy. They interviewed Seth Godin recently in New York. And the reason I like that is there's this real relaxed, down-to-earth conversation stuff. And I find sometimes there's a stiff formality that can come with podcast interviews, and I really like it, like what you do in your podcast, where you ask the unexpected questions or you cover ground that hasn't been as well covered, and, you know, that seems to be what naturally emerges with their show.
Wow. Daily. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's nuts.
E-newsletters. Are there any e-newsletters that you subscribe to and look forward to receiving?
Yeah. So The Dense Discovery by Kai Brack is one that I really appreciate. Kai was a pioneer behind Offscreen Mag, which is looking at the people behind the pixels. His sense of things is just really on point. I also appreciate Farnham Street, the thinking that goes into that. Oh, the Inventium newsletter, of course, you know, own newsletter.
Gold.
That would probably be the main things. I mean, of course, there are other newsletters. I wish I hadn't, you know, mentioned them, but yeah, that's probably it.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. And Jace, finally, if people want to read more of your stuff, learn more about you, where are the best places to find you?
Right. So, thank you. DrJasonFox.com is the place, although I'd suggest subscribing to my newsletter. It's what I do in between books, and it's the thing I'm probably most proud about in terms of my own writing. So, that's DrJasonFox.com/ahoy. I do have a podcast. It's a little bit more nascent and still germinating when compared to yours, but it's an opportunity for me to delve a little bit deeper into some of the questions I'm asked after keynotes or via email by my newsletter subscribers. So that can be found at drjasonfox.com/podcast or The Cleverness with Dr. Jason Fox.
Awesome. Love it. Cool. Well, I have loved this chat, Jace.
Thanks.
It's nice finding the time to just sit down and have a chat and
so
talk about how we work. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello there. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you got some useful tips and insights from my chat with Jace. There's also a bunch of things that I link to in the show notes from all the books and apps and technology that Jace mentioned during the chat, so you can just check them out wherever you listen to your podcasts. And as I always say, and you're probably sick of hearing, if you are enjoying how I work, I would love it if you could either leave a review or maybe share some episodes that you've really loved with other people that you think could benefit from them. And also, if you don't already subscribe, just click the subscribe button and you will be notified whenever a new episode drops. That's it from me, and I'll see you next time.